We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Wait, isn't this the set for the show Glee?
What?
No, you're wrong studio.
Oh, okay.
All right.
So what are you going to talk about?
Yeah, I reach over here.
Yeah, I know.
Smack you to wake you up a little.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was up late last night. Yeah, she'd like that, wouldn't she?
I think listeners might like that, too. All right. Hey, let's big election.
Yes.
Yeah, in the U.S.
Indeed. As big as they get.
Yeah. So
lots of results there to talk about.
Yeah, we're going to start out with the local results.
Rob McKenna conceded last night.
Finally.
Yeah, he's down 55,000 votes in the governor's race, and the two remaining races that are really fairly close have nearly that margins. So they're probably done as well. That's Wyman up over Kathleen Drew for the Secretary of State, and then Charters, she's up by 42,000 votes as of last night, mm-hmm. and then for the Charter Schools Initiative, that's also about a 44,000 vote margin, so that's likely to pass at this point.
Yeah, it really kind of proves that, it puts a price tag on what it costs to pass an initiative in the state of Washington. The pro-charter school people spend about $11 million to get it passed, and that's about what it takes.
Yeah, and about $300,000 that the anti-charter schools raised?
They had around $600,000 to $700,000 total.
It's still about a 15-to-1 margin.
Yeah, about a 15-to-1 margin, less than $1 million that they had in their pockets. So yeah, no, it really shows you that if you pour enough money in and the other side has very little funds to counter you, you can get an initiative pass even if it's only by about 40,000 vote margin.
Yeah. On the other hand, we have gay marriage in Washington State, mm-hmm. along with Maryland and Maine, the first states to pass it by voter initiative. And then the state of Minnesota also, and this wasn't expected to happen there, also rejected an anti-gay marriage amendment. So
very good
day for that. And then Colorado and Washington passing pot legalization as well, although I was somewhat surprised that Oregon did not. But we got those both here.
I think what's very interesting about both those initiatives is the polling that went on this summer when the media was telling us, oh, it's very close, oh, these initiatives probably won't pass, blah, blah, blah. And here, you know, we come to Election Day, and they both passed by margins much wider than I thought they would. That was very surprising.
I can tell you I was involved with some of the people who were involved in the POD initiative, mm-hmm. and their internal polling was showing that it was very
much
close.
Better. Yeah,
that it was very close, and they were very concerned that there was going to be a bias in the polls, that people would answer the pollsters yes on that, when in fact they would get to the polling place and vote no, that there was that built-in bias. And the R74 folks were worried about the same thing. And it actually worked the other way.
Yeah,
that
which is interesting.
The margin was larger on Election Day than the polling showed all the way up until the end.
Well, and it makes me wonder too how accurate our polls are in terms of, particularly in terms of calling up younger voters who carry cell phones or maybe more difficult to reach.
Yeah, they're trying to adjust for that now in polls, as opposed to 3 or 4 years ago when they were still catching up. But
yeah.
you wonder what the algorithms are using for that, how accurate they are. Nationally, they turned out very well, but you're working with a smaller sample size generally on these statewide initiatives.
Yeah, yeah. And then also among the initiatives, too, Initiative 1185, Tim Eymann's two-thirds majority, a requirement of a two-thirds majority in the legislature to pass any kind of tax increases or fee increases. That one also passed by a very wide margin.
Yeah, 63%. It didn't pass by two-thirds, so I don't think it should take effect. But there's two pieces of good news on that. Number one is that 1185 is virtually identical to the initiative, I believe it was 1042, that mm-hmm. Eymann passed 2 years ago. He has to do this every 2 years because, of course, in 2 years the legislature can amend it or overturn it.
Mm-hmm.
So the previous initiative was actually struck down by the courts earlier this year and is now an appeal to the Washington State Supreme Court. So that's already being litigated and has been found wanting by the courts. 1185 will almost certainly follow in that path. So if one is found unconstitutional, the other almost certainly will be as well. That's the one piece of good news. The other piece of good news is that we now have a governor who is likely to have both the conviction and the political courage to seek fee increases where Christine Gregoire did not and Gary Locke before her did not. Mm-hmm. But Jay Inslee, I think, is he's And I've said this before the election as well. He's probably the most progressive governor we've had since Mike Lowry in 20 years. And not only is he the most progressive governor we've had in a long time, but he's also effective. The one question with him is he's never held an executive branch office. He's always been a legislator, but he's shown a lot of results, as a legislator, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he'll do in Olympia.
Yeah, and other news about that governor's race too. What I found really interesting about the governor's race is McKenna had the advantage of an enormous amount of money poured into his race by the Republican Party and by out-of-state interests. And even with all that extra money to run attack ads against Inslee, McKenna still couldn't get the governorship here.
Yeah. Although, I think his race for Senate started yesterday. he'll be going after that for the next couple of years. But yeah, Rob McKenna he was up in the polls all the way until the primary, and then Inslee won the primary, and it was by about the same margin. Mm-hmm. And it was very stable all the way through November, even though there was an enormous amount of money poured into that race. And the same was true nationally with Obama-Romney, where, if you look at the aggregate of the state polls, as opposed to the nationwide polling numbers, which a lot of news organizations like to point to make their piece appear closer than it appeared, Obama was at or above 300 electoral votes all year long. The lowest I saw him winning by was like 297 all year. So the race was never nearly as close as what we were hearing in the media.
Yeah.
That's a function of two things. One, the right-wing echo chamber, which really and truly had convinced itself, even on election night, that this was going to be a landslide for Romney because, as we've said this show many every week for the last number of them, they live in an alternate universe. Mm-hmm. And they had convinced themselves that, the Romney camp had convinced itself because it made assumptions about there's going to be a lower turnout of non-whites than there was in 2008. There's going to be a lower turnout of the youth vote than there was in 2008. And they didn't even test those assumptions with their internal polling. They just built them into their internal polling, and so they got the results that they want. And Rasmussen and Gallup in their polls did the same thing, which is why they were outliers. And it was really a triumph on Tuesday for reality over the alternate reality.
Yeah, it was.
So the polling was very stable all year, showing Obama winning almost all the swing states, which he in fact did. And it didn't change over the months. I mean, it changed a little bit after that first debate. There was a wobble in the polls. But the overall arc of the campaign, we wound up in almost exactly the same place we were in June when Romney had the Republican nomination. And all of that money didn't change anything.
Yeah, and I've got a couple of the numbers here in terms of all of that money. Each of the presidential campaigns spent about $1 billion each. And then outside of the campaigns themselves in these super PACs, all told, they spent another $1 billion. So $3 billion poured into the presidential race, about three times more than was spent in all of, $6 billion total in all of the races. If you take all the federal races around the country, senatorial races, et cetera, about $6 billion all told. And it was about three times more than was poured into campaigns in 2010 because of the Citizens United decision. And
we wonder why they hate
us. What was the result? Yeah. And what was the result? If you look at these Republican PACs where they poured all this money into races to try to defeat Democrats in order to take control of the Senate, they were it was a profound failure on the part of the Republican Party.
Yeah. Well, yes and no, because we don't know what the races would have looked like without all that money. They might have been even wider victories for the Democrats. We certainly mm-hmm. saw that in the House where the money made a difference and the redistricting made a difference.
Yeah, I think it was the redistricting.
These weren't the same districts that they were in 2010. Mm-hmm. And to pick the most obvious example, Michelle Bachmann would have not won in her 2010 mm-hmm. district. She won by a sliver because the district was redrawn to be more favorable for her. And you saw that all over the country, so that you can have a popular vote victory for Obama in terms of the overall national vote, and you figure that's roughly going to be analogous to what the House vote looks like. And in fact, I believe there were more votes cast for Democrats in House races than there were for Republicans. But the Republicans control a greater number of seats because of the way the districts were drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Also interesting, to me in the national race, there's a lot of stories coming out now about how the Romney campaign spent all of that money that it had. And they were very prolific. It's, you know, yet another one of these narratives of, well, when we tell you that we're going to run government like we run a business, these people who are used to running businesses are used to wasting money in a way that government does not. So you had, you know, Romney with a terribly inefficient get out the vote, effort, buying TV ads at a much higher rate than Obama did because it was all last minute stuff because they didn't plan it out, you know, not planning for defeat on the night of so that they had this, you know, $26,000 whatever it was fireworks display planned for over Boston Harbor, and then cutting off the credit cards of their staff before they even had a chance to get home after the election night party. So it really does show you a culture clash between between how people in that stratosphere think and how other people think.
Yeah.
One other thing that we didn't mention on local elections, which is a couple of them. I couldn't help but notice in terms of the Washington state returns for the presidency, Jill Stein only got about 16,000 votes for president statewide, and Rocky Anderson got another 4,000, which shows you how small the third party votes for president were. On the other hand, in the 43rd district, Kashama Sawant, running as an open socialist against Frank Chop, she got 16,000 votes just in the 43rd district.
She got 27%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, it's up to 28 as of last night.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and they are talking in conjunction with some other progressives about trying to run a slate, at least for city council and potentially also for mayor for next year. Mm-hmm. And that organizing literally is starting this week. So
yeah.
They did a great job, and she's a phenomenal candidate. So I hope she does run again next year.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention a couple of other things too about the national election. One of the things that we're hearing a lot now is the Republicans talking about, well, you know, Romney was hurt by his stance on immigration and the Hispanic vote turned out in record numbers for Obama. And yes, that's true. But I don't think that's the reason Obama won. I think what people are forgetting is that the Hispanic vote had nothing to do with Obama winning in states like Minnesota and Michigan and Ohio, some of the big swing states. What really, you know, you have to look at those states and you have to say, okay, it was working class white people, essentially, who decided that a rich man who made obscene amounts of money on Wall Street didn't represent them, and they decided to vote for an African American man instead.
In that sense, Michigan and Ohio in particular, the whole auto industry thing, mm-hmm. both the electrical bankrupt history of Romney and then the ad about Chrysler sending Jeep production to China,
and
that really hurt him.
Yeah, and again, you know, you had Romney lying to them a lot of the time by saying, oh, no, I would have helped the auto industry, when in fact he had said, I would have let it go bankrupt. You know, you can't, yeah, these people, they pay close attention. I mean, everyone pays close attention to what the candidates say, really. I mean, and people went to the polls, they looked at Obama, and they said, well, we know what Obama's about because he's had 4 years to tell us. Romney, every time anyone would ask him, what will you do if you're elected, the most he would ever say, he had no plan for anything, he had no specifics on anything, the most he would ever say is less government.
He'd say, I have a plan, but just wouldn't go into any
of
the
specifics. Yeah, and he
wouldn't
go into any detail. And then when they'd say, give us some specifics, he'd go on and on about, well, I don't think the government should get involved in blah, blah, blah. So less government, less government, less government. So people were thinking, well, I can vote for Obama knowing what he is, or I can vote for Romney, and clearly here's a man who wants to get elected so that he'll do nothing. I think a lot of people went to the poll saying, you know, heck with Romney, I'm going to vote for what I know. And that helped put Obama over the top, I think. But I also want to wanted to point out too that it isn't just minority voters that voted for Obama. There were plenty of working class white people who also said, you know, I think the rich should pay more in taxes. Therefore, I think Obama should be president.
One of the other things we're hearing, there's sort of a lot of post-election stuff about, well, you know, we've seen the demographic shifts in the country now. This is clearly favoring the Democrats. This was the last shot for the Republicans to run a national campaign basically on bigotry and hatred of the other. And they're going to have to reform now in order to remain competitive in the future because, you know, you've got all of these, you know, Pennsylvania used to be a swing state. It isn't anymore. Yeah. Ohio's moving away from being a swing state. Florida is changing in 4 years, and certainly in 8 years, Texas is going to be a swing state. You know, the map is working against them. Mm-hmm. But we have a track record that shows that the Republicans aren't going to do that. More than likely, they're going to double down on the crazy yet again, and it's going to be like this certainly for another 4 years. And that is that we've seen this already in the state of California. Which is now a majority-minority state, mm-hmm. Where, you know, 20 years ago, the Republicans controlled a lot of the levers of government in California. Right now, Republicans are under 30% of registered voters in the state of California, and the reason they are is that they have doubled and quadrupled down on the crazy. And so you've got, as of this week, you know, there are 55 people in Congress from the state of California, 38 of them are Democrats. Of those 38, 18 are women and 17 are non-white. You only have 15 Republicans and they're all white men. Mm-hmm. That's what the future of the Republican Party looks like. It, you know, in California now, it's basically the size of what the Republican Party was in the South during Jim Crow. Yeah. It's not relevant. And they would rather stick to their bigotry and their alternate universe, at least in California, than acknowledge reality and try and reform what they stand for and what the public perceives that they stand for.
And no,
I think that's what we're going to see nationally, too.
And no amount of money can overcome that. You know?
No.
And that's what this election proved, that you can pour billions of dollars into into campaigns for candidates who, you know, believe that abortion should be illegal in all cases, including rape, you know, and you will not be able to buy the women's vote. You will not be able to elect people into office who are crazy.
It was a bad night for legitimate rape.
it was.
Made me want to cry.
Yeah.
The other thing is that, you know, all of the stuff that was done around voter suppression, and you look at the reports on election day of voter suppression, I mean, let alone all the voter registration things that went on, five states in particular where it was a big deal, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin, a lot of election day shenanigans going on in those states. They all went for Obama anyway. You know, if it's not in Florida's case, it was close. Most of those were perceived ahead of time to be swing states, and most of those it didn't turn out to be close. But you know, as Obama said in his victory speech, we've got to look at that. We've got to figure out a way to protect people's rights to vote in a democracy, because the more isolated the Republican Party is going to get, the more they're going to try and resort to that.
Yeah, and this comes at a time too. Just yesterday, when the Supreme Court said, well, we're going to look at the Voting Rights Act, you know, and you're like, I'm looking at that, I'm going, why repeal a law that works? You know, if it's ensuring the rights of voters,
that's why they want to repeal
it. Exactly. If it's ensuring the rights of voters, you don't try to overturn it at the Supreme Court, unless, of course, you have a Supreme Court that is so conservative and so for the Republican Party that they want to do anything they can to help them.
And that really was possibly the single most important outcome of the presidential race this year. You know, we're going to get a lot of congressional gridlock over the next 4 years, or certainly over the next two if the Republicans maintain control of the House in 2014, then for the next four. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Obama's going to have at least one, potentially a couple more Supreme Court nominations. And if those had gone to Mitt Romney instead, we would have lost Roe v. Wade. We might well have lost Griswold. We would have lost, you know, we are very, very close now to, and it's already happened in a number of cases, Citizens United being only the most notorious, where a lot of things that were taken for granted in the Bill of Rights have been stripped away. Mm-hmm. And it's not like Obama has any great shakes on some of those issues. But, you know, the Supreme Court, is one vote away from being a very radical Supreme Court, and Mitt Romney was very explicit about he liked that radical Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So that was the real bullet that we dodged this week.
And I think it goes without saying, then why would I be saying it? But this next 4 years is critical for people that, you know, just voting and having good election outcomes isn't nearly enough.
Yeah, I was very pleased to hear, actually, during his victory speech, Obama himself said this, and, you know, we say this in our election endorsements every year, voting is not enough. The work of a citizen does not stop with casting a vote. We still have a lot of work to do,
especially
on issues that we know the federal government is not in a position to act on, climate change being a huge one, for example, that, you know, we're not going to get anything done at that level of government, at least for the foreseeable future. We've got to start taking action at other levels.
All right. So let's move on from that and jump back to a couple local items, starting with the City Council budget survey.
Yeah, the City Council did an online budget survey a few weeks back, and they released the results of the survey in a format that I found extremely irritating. Bar graphs without any particular numbers attached to them. And I have to just say, I hate word clouds. I find word clouds to be absolutely meaningless. But this budget survey has a couple of them. And so my big question is, why couldn't they just give us the numbers along with the bar graphs and just leave the word clouds, I don't know, in the circular file? But it shows what kind of surprised me about the online survey, which was a survey of people who just kind of randomly self-selected.
So it's, went not, online it's not a scientific survey.
It's
anyway.
Not a scientific survey. They went online and answered questions for the City Council. So basically a survey of people who are interested in these kinds of things. And
who have access to the website.
Yes. And what I found interesting was that transit services and street maintenance issues ranked in the top five priorities and the top five most important local government services, along with the things you would expect, like police, fire, and schools, even though schools really don't have anything to do with the city. And I'm not sure why schools were listed there in the first place.
They want to know what to run on.
Yeah, really. So transit services were up there pretty high. And then what I found interesting was that according to this survey, hiring more police is not something that people find all that important. That, in fact, more people said, no, we have the right amount. No, we need fewer officers or other than who said, yes, we need more police. And yet the City Council, which is just wrapping up its budget sessions and is going to try to pass a new budget here before they go on their Thanksgiving holiday, they have millions built into the budget in order to hire more police officers. As Jobs said, I think maybe they're thinking about their next city council race, saying, haha, you should reelect me. I put more money in the budget for hiring more police.
Actually, I have them running for mayor next year, and that's what they're going to talk about.
Right. So that's my take on the online survey.
All right. Victory for Veterans for Peace.
Yeah, U.S. District Chief Judge Marsha Peckman yesterday ordered the city of Auburn to allow the local Veterans for Peace folks to march in the Veterans Day Parade today. The Auburn Parade is the largest Veterans Day Parade, I believe, west of the Mississippi.
As they've
it's
done
a big deal
for many
in the past.
Years now, but
yeah.
This year, for some reason, the Auburn...
Well, actually, they've had flack from the city of Auburn before,
yeah.
But they've never...
Never been kicked out of the parade.
They've been denied initially and then let in before. I believe, but
yeah.
But it didn't take, you know, until the day before with a court order.
Yeah.
Now it was interesting that the city of Auburn argued that they shouldn't be included because the day was to honor veterans, and promoting peace distracts from honoring veterans and is inherently critical of the job that veterans have done. Now, for folks who may have missed the 3 seconds in high school civics or history class that was devoted to this. Veterans Day started out as Armistice Day at the end of World War I. It was not a holiday to honor veterans. It was a holiday to honor peace and the fact that people who fought in wars didn't have to fight anymore. Mm-hmm. World War I, of course, and it wasn't even titled World War I then. It was the Great War. Was meant to be the war to end all wars. And the thought that Armistice Day was a day to mark the beginning of our permanent peace. And so, you know, the idea that you could have elected officials saying, well, we can't have peace in a parade that commemorates a day that was founded in order to celebrate peace because that would distract from the message. It really is kind of a microcosm of just how ingrained militarism and the glorification of war has become in our culture. And so I'm really glad that the veterans will be marching today. And if you want to go down there and join them, the parade starts at 11 o'clock.
All right. And related to that, a hearing taking place at Joint Base Lewis-McChord?
Yeah, Robert Bales, who folks may remember was accused a number of months ago of killing 16 Afghan civilians, had an Article 32 hearing, which is essentially the military equivalent of a pretrial hearing going on all this week around that. And the military showed some of the evidence they had that he was involved in these killings, even though, especially because he's it's a local story. You've had all these stories in the paper about how he's a model soldier and a great dad and a really nice person. He couldn't possibly have done this. Well, there's an awful lot of evidence that he did in fact do this or was at least involved in it. The real question is, was he the only one? That there are a number of eyewitness accounts saying that there was more than one soldier involved. But there's kind of a schism in the defense argument between, well, he wasn't there at all and he couldn't have possibly done this by himself. So it's going to be an interesting court martial. And, we've seen in military justice in the past where, the official story that's put out by the military of what happened tends to lean on the one bad apple theory, tends to lean on the idea that, well, we had this one soldier who just went nuts because he did exactly what we trained him to do, kill a bunch of people. There may be a lot more than that here. And we're not going to find out until and maybe not even when we have the trial on this.
All right. Events.
Several events going on today. As we mentioned, 11 o'clock, the Auburn Veterans Day for Parade. Veterans for Peace will be marching in that. From 10:30 until 4 o'clock today, Sustainable Ballard and Sustainable Seattle will be having its Fall Forward event and workshops and conference. That's at 999 North North Lake Way in North Seattle. It's up north. Tomorrow, from 4:30 to 7:30, the 4th Annual Coffee Strong Dinner and Dessert Auction, a great fundraiser for a great cause, the coffee shop down across from Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It's $40 to get you in at the Seattle Labor Temple, 2800 First at Broad in Belltown. And then on Friday, November 16th, next week, from 6 to 8 p.m., it's on Saturday also, the Labor Studies and the Future 20th Anniversary Conference. The keynote on Friday night by Tom McGogan at Kane 320 on the University of Washington campus, and then all day Saturday at the Hub Building, the Student Union Building, room 334 on the beautiful University of Washington campus.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find more of my work at mariatomchick.com.